Okay, it's good to be back here with the Chizuk Mission. I was just earlier in the week with the with your predecessors, who we just finished with. And I'm looking forward not only to being with you here today, but Be'ezrat Hashem, I'm going to be spending Shabbos with you as well. It's very exciting. The time is a little bit short, as it always is. Is Barry here? Stepped out. The time is always short when it comes to the Chizuk Mission because nothing ever runs exactly on time. So I think
it's because of the women that
are so lovely. It's because the incredible speakers always run over time. So we don't have that much time, so I want to just jump in to a topic that I think is very relevant not only for the time that we're living in, but also really in a general sense. I want to share with you a Gemara. The pasuk in Megillas Esther says as follows: Vayomer Haman lemelech Achashverosh. Haman is speaking to Achashverosh, and this is his pitch. This is why we're going to get rid of Klal Yisrael. He says, Yashno am echad mefuzur mefurad bein ha'amim. There is one nation that's scattered amongst all the nations. Bechol midonos machosach, in all your provinces. V'dasaseim shonos mikol ha'am. V'esdasei ha'melech eino osim. And they're different from everybody else. They follow their own laws, and they don't do what you, the king, want. And it's not worth it for you to have him in the kingdom. That's what the pasuk says. This is Haman's argument. It's not a new argument. It's an argument that's been made time and again throughout history. Jews don't fit. Better to expel them from the land. Okay, stay there. There's a Gemara, a strange Gemara, a perplexing Gemara, but a Gemara that needs to be unpacked well in order for us to understand this pasuk. The Gemara says as follows: Yeshno am echad. What does it mean that there was one nation? Amar Rava, leka deyada lishna bisha kahaman. There was no one who knew how to slander, how to attack, like Haman HaRasha. There was nobody like him. He was the best of the best. Amar lei, tanichalnu. He said to Achashverosh, "Let's destroy Klal Yisrael." So Amar Le, Achashverosh said back to him, Mistafina melokayu dololi avibe kida avid bekame. I'm afraid of their God. I've seen what happens before. What happens when you attack the Jews? HaKadosh Baruch Hu protects them. It's the end of our reign. This is Achashverosh's fear. This is what the Gemara tells us. So Haman responds, strange response. Amar Le, Haman says back to him, and this is the end of the Gemara, Yashnu min ha-mitzvos. When it says in the Gemara, Yeshno am echad, that there's one nation, really, Haman says, Yeshno is Yashno. They're sleeping from doing the mitzvos. That's Haman's argument. Don't worry, Hashem doesn't have their back because they're sleeping from doing the mitzvos. If you look at this Gemara, though, there's two things that bother us very much, two things that we really need to unpack for ourselves. That's a very strange thing to say. We're sleeping from doing the mitzvos. What should Haman have said? Hashem's not going to have their back because we're not what? We're not keeping the mitzvos. We're not doing the mitzvos. It's a strange thing to say that Haman says they're sleeping through the mitzvos. What does it mean to sleep through a mitzvah? Okay, to do it some way, what does it mean? Like, it sounds like Haman was saying in some way there's something unconscious, it's by rote, they're just going through the motions. That's perhaps a great start, but we're going to need to unpack it very deeply because there's a second question. The second question is as follows. If the Gemara tells us that Haman had a drasha, don't read it yeshno, rather yashno. Don't read it there is, but they're sleeping. What were the words that Haman said, though? Let's look at the actual words. There's one nation, they're scattered. They're everywhere. And they're sleeping through their mitzvos. Do you see the problem? Those are two very different things. Whenever there's a drasha, the drasha has to work together. The thing that Haman is saying has to connect to the drasha. So Haman says there's a scattered nation. What does scattered nation mean? It means they're sleeping through the mitzvos. What does one of those have to do with the other? You hear the second question? I don't know if I said it so well. Did everyone get that second question? Should I say it again?
No.
Yeah? I'll say it one last time just to make sure everyone gets it. Haman's argument to Achashverosh, according to the pasuk, is take Klal Yisrael out, they're mefuzar umefura, they're scattered among the nations, they're different than everyone else. They don't listen to your laws, they're not like everybody else. The Gemara tells us that there was a subcontext to that conversation. That their yeshno is yashno, they're sleeping through the mitzvos. Those are two very different subjects. The subject of being separated from the nation, separated from each other, they're scattered, that's, what does that have to do with the fact that they're sleeping through the mitzvos? Obviously they have something to do with each other, because the Gemara is putting them together, Haman is putting them together. But it seems to be a very, like, two diverse, totally different topics. Obviously they're one, we have to understand how they're one. That's the two questions we have for today, and now we'll get started. I want to talk to you about a vulnerability that I know I'm feeling very much in my life, and I'm seeing it wherever I go. And the vulnerability is to live in harmony. It's a very difficult thing to live in harmony. What does it mean to live in harmony? Just don't raise your hand. I'm sure the answer is most people here. A lot of us feel like things in my life, there, if you're here on the Chizuk mission, I'm pretty confident you feel this way. Things in my life might be working, but they're not working well. There's something disjointed. Like, for example, we could have children. What do we want from our family? We want from our family to be in harmony. How many people here, you don't have to raise your hands, how many people here have ever created disharmony in your family by wanting so badly for there to be harmony in your family? Okay, you didn't have to raise your hands and you certainly didn't need to dap each other up, but yeah, it's you know what it is? It's like my mother, who's an amazing person, I have nothing bad to say about her, she's an incredible person. She wanted so badly for the kids never to fight. Yeah, every mother wants that. But like some mothers really want that. My mother really wanted that. So, you know, like the family pictures with smile, we're having a good time. You know. Have you had this experience, right? So we would get like a pre-vacation speech. We're investing a lot of money. We really want everyone to have a good time. And I was the oldest in the family. She would say, please include your little brother. So we would be beating the snot out of him. And my mother would go, what are you doing? I'm like, including him. You know? So often, we create the disharmony from our toxic need for harmony. So the kids don't have permission to be fighting with each other, because there's such a need from the parents to make sure that everything goes well. But actually, if you kind of think about it, a disharmony vacation in some ways is nicer than a harmonious vacation, right? Like that dystopian reality of like, it's going to be perfect and everyone's going to get along the entire time, right? But there's also something beautiful about the cheppering of kids that just like...
Acting like kids.
Yeah, they act like children. Like, sometimes I think to myself, the things that my kids say to each other, I'm like, how come I'm not allowed to say that to them as a parent? You know what I'm talking about? Like, I have one daughter and she's going through something right now, and I have another daughter who's 17 years old, and you've met her. She has no filter. Zero filter. If there's a word in her brain, it's already out of her mouth. Am I exaggerating?
No.
Not even a little bit. So she will look at my other daughter, and she'll just say to her, she's like, enough with your desperation. And it's like, and I'm like, thank you for saying it, you know, because I as a parent can't say it, you know. This need for harmony in our lives, it's a very beautiful need, and most of us don't have it. Without raising your hands, answer here, I'm sure, is everybody. On some level, how many of us are experiencing the level of harmony that we want in our marriages? We could have even a good, healthy marriage, but it doesn't always mean that it's operating well. Something is disharmonious in the marriage. Something is pulling at us. There's words left unspoken. There's things I just don't feel I could say. There's not a space for me to be myself here, right? There's a lot of pain in the disharmony of our relationships. How many people, when we think about Okay, work-life balance. You are here, which means that you hit pause on something in your life to be able to attain the balance that you want to get from this mission, right? Otherwise, you wouldn't have left. It's no simple thing to be able to stop. What are you here for, a week? It's no simple thing to stop and to be here and to say, I'd like to hit pause on my life so that I can recalibrate. That's no simple thing. It speaks to our need for harmony. It speaks to our need for things to be working well together. Why aren't things working well? It's a good question, no? You know, it's a vulnerable question because if they're not working well, what does that mean? It means I'm contributing something to this dysfunction. Is this somebody's? I have no idea. Yeah?
Oh, she didn't drink from it. She didn't
okay.
Drink from it. You can have it.
Do you know what it is?
She was back up.
Oh my God, she was drinking the entire time. It's vulnerable to say that things in my life are not going well because then I know that I'm going to have to recalibrate. Because I can't control the other person, I can only control myself. And paying attention to the disharmony within ourselves makes me feel inadequate. Means that I didn't do enough as a mother. Well, you didn't do enough as a mother. I didn't do enough as a father to create the harmony in the family that I really wanted. I didn't do enough as a husband to create the harmony in this relationship that I wanted. There's something very vulnerable about even acknowledging that things aren't going well. How many couples will, quote unquote, soldier through, soldier on, because it's easier to say it's good enough rather than continue to aim for what it could be? How many people won't say, I'm not okay with the way you're showing up to this relationship because it's easier for me to swallow my words than it is to have the hard conversation because I might get feedback in that conversation. Ooh, this is harsh. By the way, I want you to know I read rooms for a living. This was, look, we're real people on the Chizuk mission, right? So we're willing to have the hard conversation. And I see, as I'm speaking, I want you to know what your faces look like, at least to me up here. There's a lot of people that just went like this. Ooh. We're all in the same boat. Nobody here is better than anybody else, and we don't have to pretend that we're perfect. We don't have to pretend that we're perfect parents, or that we have the perfect marriage, and we don't have to pretend that our jobs are going well all the time, or that I'm able to manage all the million things that I'm doing in my life. The responsibilities of being an Orthodox Jew today are enormous. I have to be able to have the healthy finances to be able to live in our community. Our community is insanely wealthy, Begadol, because we live here and we have to keep that standard. So we have to make that money, raise our children, spend time with our husbands, take care of ourselves, engage in our own personal growth. How many people here feel that they're doing that well, even in a general sense? Most people I speak to are telling me, this is really hard. And the people that I speak to that tell me, yeah, no, I'm doing good, it's only a short amount of time until they say, I had that unmentalized process of thinking that I was doing well, until they realize they're not. In a certain sense, what you might say about our lives is that they're imbalanced. We have tainas on our spouses, right? You're spending too much time away from the family. What's the husband's response? Who's paying for this? How many times have you heard from your husband, not you, but you, yeah? I'm so sick of feeling like a bank. But the only time that I feel valued is when people come to me and say, can we get, but how many people actually appreciate me? All I hear from you is the negative feedback of I'm not around enough. There's something imbalanced about our life, and the question is, how do we achieve balance without trying to achieve perfection? Yeah? Because balance and perfection have nothing to do with each other. Perfectionism is a way of being that's designed to take us away from balance. Because if you have to be perfect, then what are you not able to be?
Normal.
Yeah. You can't be in balance because balanced people know how to say, ouch, that hurt, I didn't do well at that, that's okay, and move on. So how can I be enough and be balanced without having to be perfect or dysfunctional? Do you ever notice that that's the way that people use balance today? They use it to excuse dysfunction in their lives. There are people that don't know how to appropriately use the word self-care. Right? Self-care can be a weapon that we use to excuse our dysfunction. Or self-care is a word that we could use to be truly in balance. And it's not obvious where you draw that line, right? You want to hear a great one?
Yeah.
If anybody ever asks you where you draw the line, the answer is somewhere. It's an amazing line. Because that's what every shiur I give. They go, but yeah, but where do you draw the line? I go, somewhere, right? You have to figure out where your somewhere is. But how many people growing up today are saying, I need to engage in more self-care appropriately because it's impossible for me to be a wife and a mother and working and managing everybody's crisis. I also need to take care of myself. Of course you do. But what's the negative impact of that self-care? If you're taking care of yourself, then that means there's something that's not being taken care of. So that's okay. Other people can pick up the pieces. But at what point does self-care become selfish? Or at what point is self-care the tool that I'm using to stay in balance? So there's a formula. I want to share with you this formula. It's not a hard formula, but it's a little deep. You ready?
Yeah.
Okay. Formula is this. There's something called a body and a soul. If the body is driving the soul, you're out of balance. I'll explain what this means in a moment. If the soul is driving the body, you're in balance. And if you take a look at your life, in the areas that you're out of balance, it's because the body is driving the soul and the soul is not driving the body. I'll explain what this means. The nature of the body is that it is ridiculously conscious of death. That's the nature of the body. Your body has a spirit to it. In Hasidic language, this is called the Nefesh HaBahamis. Anyone here ever learned Tanya before? Okay. Your body has a worldview. The worldview is, I am here to animate your body. But what's the problem with the body's animation? One day, the body will die. So the body consciousness has a certain vulnerability, a certain desperation to stay alive. That's why people do crazy things to feel alive. I'm embarrassed to ask this question. I'm sure the answer is nobody. How many people here have jumped out of a plane? Okay. I didn't do it. You did it. Okay, good. So we have here an incredible mother. I've met mothers like you before. You're the most incredible mothers. I met a mother who said to me, I hate football, but my son is obsessed with football, so I sat on the couch and I watched football with him every week. You're an amazing mother. You had no interest in jumping out of a plane, but your son did. So look at this mother enabling her son to do this crazy thing. Baruch Hashem, a wonderful mother, yeah? When you landed, what did you feel? Okay, you were terrified that night.
The night after?
After. Why?
Shock, because I realized that it was just a crazy thing to do.
Okay, good. This is perfect. Thank you for, I laid it up, but you dunked it home. Way to go, I appreciate it. Because what you did and what your son wanted to do. Yeah, but listen, it's clear to me that Hashkacha dictated we should arrive at this moment. When you jump out of a plane because you have your brush with death, people say when they land, I feel so alive. My heart is beating like crazy. And it stays with you. It's such a rush. The nature of the body is it says, you know, one day you're going to die. So it lives from a place of death. Can I share with you what this looks like as a parent?
Yeah.
If my kid is not okay, I'm not okay.
You're only as happy as your happiest kid.
Which is a terrible way to live. Okay, but we're going to see that there might be a different way of doing it. Because if my happiness is dependent, very good, thank you for laying it up. If my happiness is dependent on another, if I'm not okay because they're not okay, I'm parenting from a place of fear. How do you think that's going to go?
Not so great.
Because that means we're trying to draw power from our children. It means I'm not enough for myself because I know that this could end really badly. So I'm trying to draw power from something else. If my husband comes home from work and he had a really bad day at the office, and I'm living in fear that he's going to take it out on the family that night because he's running on empty, so I say I have to be the perfect wife to make sure everything in the home is exactly perfect when he walks in. It's what we call codependency. Codependency is a way of avoiding a certain type of death. I'm not going to be okay if he's not okay. So therefore, I'm drawing power from everybody else. Does that make sense?
Yes.
That's a body way of living, and that means that the soul is following the body. Okay? Here's the opposite. The nature of the soul is it has infinite of whatever it needs. Because the soul is an infinite piece of God, the soul has an infinite amount of whatever it needs. Or to put it differently, the nature of the soul is that the soul is enough. The soul is enough. So what would it look like to parent from a soulful place? My kid walks in the door. He has that look on his face, and you know that look. It's the look of, I have bad news to tell you, and I just have to figure out how to package it. Yeah? He walks in and he says, I got called into the principal's office today, fill in the blank, because I did the following stupid thing. Let's say, for example, he said, I had this crazy moment, and the history teacher, we never know if he's paying attention or not, so I opened the window before class, and when the teacher was kind of looking in my direction just to see what would happen, I walked out of the window onto the adjacent building, which is connected, and then I jumped off of that building onto the sidewalk and cut school just to see if the teacher would notice. The teacher didn't notice, but everybody in the class started laughing, so the teacher found out from one of the kids what happened and reported me to the principal. That's what happened when I was in 11th grade. It was an amazing moment. I'm going to be honest with you. It was a great moment. I just wanted to see. I just wanted to see. For those of you who are from the Five Towns, there's a school called Brandeis. There's a big building like this, a little building like that. By the way, it works. And every time I went back to Rambam to present for my yeshiva, I always like walked by that classroom just as like a zecher l'chorban, you know, just like a little bit of a remembrance of that time, right? So your kid walks in, they have that look on that on your face, right? And from a soulful place, how would you want to respond? You would want to say, okay, whatever you're about to tell me, it's okay, and I'm with you. I was in the car with a great Rosh Hashiva. I was driving, he was in the passenger seat. You know that thing that sometimes somebody's taking a private call, but the volume is on too loud, so you can hear everything that's happening, even though it's not for you? So I'm driving this Rosh Hashiva, and he gets a phone call. And I wanted to say to him, like, I can hear every word. But I it was like, you know what I'm saying? It was like that awkward, like I was too late in it, and he was clearly, I heard every word of the conversation. His son got suspended from yeshiva, okay? And the phone call was from the son letting his father know, you're going to get a phone call from the Rosh Hashiva that I'm suspended. By the way, only a couple months later, he was expelled. But in that moment, I'm sitting here with this great Rosh Hashiva, and he's on the phone with his kid, and his kid, I hear every word. The kid says to the dad, Dad, I just want to let you know, at some point today, you're going to get a phone call from the Rosh Hashiva. Yeah, I haven't been showing up to Minyan, I haven't been showing up to Seder, I've been in the workout room, and I'm going to be suspended from yeshiva. So here I am, I've got this moment. I'm driving the car, I'm not supposed to be knowing exactly what's happening, but I do. The Rosh Hashiva, totally calm, just goes like this. He goes, whatever it is, we'll get through it together. And I was like, it was incredible. And I started thinking, what would my reaction have been? When you get home, I'm going to kill you. Now, that may not have been what I said out loud, but the feeling I would have had, you know, you grip the steering wheel just a little bit tighter. Yeah, and it's not exactly road rage, but it's not exactly safe either. And I was thinking, the greatness of this Rosh Hashiva is that his son's actions didn't define him. He was totally in flow. He was soulfully parenting. His body was following his soul. What would it look like to show up to a relationship with our spouse from a place of soulfulness? My husband walks in. He has that look on his face that he had a bad day. You know that he was having a meeting with his boss today. You know he was nervous. And you could tell right away, you know, like, if you don't get the WhatsApp to let you know that it went well, so you're already, like, spending time in your head thinking, like, it probably didn't go well. And the second he walks in, you've already read his face and you know exactly how the conversation is going to go. Yeah? It doesn't have to be that exact case, but you know what I'm talking about. To soulfully engage in a relationship means to take stock and to say, whatever he needs to be right now is okay. How much better is the conversation with him going to go if he has the space to be able to express his frustration and pain that has nothing to do with you? But from the body perspective, it's like, he doesn't value me, he doesn't appreciate me, doesn't he know that I also had a bad day, how come he doesn't check in with me? There's a desperation that we have when we parent from our body as opposed to parenting from our soul. Same thing in any relationship. Think about it in terms of work-life balance. Why are you really upset at your husbands that they work as much as they do? By the way, the husbands, they have this trump card, they think that it wins, it doesn't win. We know it doesn't win, but we use it anyway, right? It's like, who's gonna pay for this? That's a husband thing to say, but I've studied your half of the species for a long enough time to know that's not what you mean. When the words come out of your mouth, this is what I've learned. Men have a completely different pattern of speaking.
And they have to go to the bathroom.
What was that? Right. Well, we made up Myrav. Myrav is a tremendous bit, by the way. I want you to, I'm going to tell you a secret. There's no such thing as Myrav. Myrav is a men's club. Yaakov Avinu made up Myrav because he had 12 kids and 4 wives. You know what I'm saying? Like, look, I want to continue this conversation. I just have to go to Myrav and I'm waking up tomorrow for MDY, right? So I know these moves. I built these moves, yeah? No, I studied them. It's a Mesorah that I have from the people that came before me. When I was newly married, I was going through Gourmet Glot, and I was shopping, and all of a sudden I hear a voice behind me. This is the Mesorah. I hear a voice behind me go, mess it up. So I turned around, and there's a famous Rebbe from the Five Towns. Well, I never had him, but all my friends did. So he kind of knew me. You know, he was a good ball player, so I had played before in the gym with him. And I turned around, and I said, what'd you say? And he goes, mess it up. So I'm like, what are you saying? He goes, you just got married, right? So I'm like, yeah, like 2 weeks ago. He goes, if you get it right now, you're going to be shopping for the rest of your marriage. And if you mess it up, you're going to be off the hook for the next 50 years. I'm giving you the secrets. And then his wife turned the corner and she goes, what did you just say? He goes, nothing, nothing. I was like, he didn't say anything. I just kept going. Haven't been shopping since. Beautiful, yeah? I came home with all the wrong things.
Specifically the 9 by 13
pounds. I know. Why do men not know what 9 by 13 pounds are? No, can I tell you what I mess up? In Israel, my wife asks me for vegetables, and I don't necessarily know all the names of them in Yesh. I can't tell the difference between a zucchini and a kohlrabi. You know what I'm talking about? So I come home with a cucumber. I'm like, is this good for the soup? You know what I'm talking about? What are we saying here? We're saying as follows. I don't remember how we got onto this, but... No, before shopping. Right. If my husband shows up and I say, I'm going to be there for him as he needs me to be, because I know that he'll be there for me as I need, right? That's where we were. If the wife says to the husband, you're spending too much time in the office, I know what that means. You ready for the translation? The translation is, I miss you. I'd like to spend more time with you. Not get a different job where you could be home more. So when the husband responds defensively and he says, I'm just the bank in this place. Do you know how much money is flying out of this place all the time? Now we've already lost each other because we're in two body conversations. As opposed to a soulful conversation where when you say, I feel like I don't get to spend enough time with you because you're at the office, and then he responds by going, what do you want me to do? Go, I just want to tell you what I meant. I understand that I just upset you. I hear that. What I'm sharing with you is I like you. And I understand that you have responsibilities. It would be awesome if we could be together more. That's vulnerable, because it means you have to say, there's something that I'm missing without you, right? But that's from a deep place of soulfulness, we can connect to each other. I'm going to share with you...
Are you saying soulful is more emotional?
I'm saying soulful is more, I'm enough for myself, and I can hold space for others who might not be okay.
What do you answer?
And I can create boundaries when they try, by the way, to take from me that which doesn't belong to them.
Such as?
Well, you know, like boundaries is also one of those toxic words, right? Because today people use boundaries as a way of keeping people out.
Right. Sure.
But in relationships, boundaries are designed to keep people in, right?
No.
When you say to your husband, this doesn't work for me, we have to remind him when we're saying those things, because I value you and because I want you to be in this space, I'm teaching you what it looks like to be in a relationship with me. That's healthy boundaries. So if something is happening that I feel is inappropriate, I get to say, I'm sorry, that's not okay. Not from a deep place of anger, but from a deep place of self. Does that make sense?
Yes, but how do you know how they're going to interpret it?
It's not your problem.
But that's okay. Because even if they're not okay with what I'm doing, that stuff belongs to them, and I don't have to scoop it up. Because if I'm scooping it up, that says more about me than it does about them. Anybody's allowed to put something in front of me, and I'm allowed to walk away from it or to choose to engage. If somebody comes to me and says, hey, I don't like the way you just showed up, I can say, okay, let me think about this. You're saying something that I want to take in, and because I'm enough, I'm okay for the musser. Or alternatively, I see that stuff. That's not my stuff. You know, I had a Talmud. This is an amazing Talmud. And he said to me, he said, I'm about to start dating. So he said, I came up with this mashal of like how to think about dating. He said, I am a house. He said, I'm a house. And there are things that I need to do before I get married. The first thing I need to know is just because somebody knocks on my door doesn't mean I have to open. And meaning, somebody could say, hey, I need your time right now. Right? And you could go, it's okay. I'll make time for you, but I'm going to open the door when it's appropriate for everybody. He said, I need to have a label maker in my house so that I can know whose stuff belongs to whom. I need to know what's in the basement of my house hidden away in the corner because I know that that stuff that I'm bringing into the house is going to have an impact on the relationship. So I said, and how long have you been in therapy? He goes, about 6 months. You know, like, well, he was young. He doesn't have... A yeshiva called Mevaseret.
Oh, yeah.
He's an amazing guy. He's an amazing guy. But how many of us... Right, how many of us are operating from a place of not knowing what's in our basement, opening doors that we shouldn't be opening, right? Thinking that somebody else's stuff belongs to us or that our stuff belongs to somebody else. This mashal, by the way, you could do it for hours. It's an amazing mashal, and I've done it. It's an amazing mashal. There's a reason. Everyone in the whole world right now, every rabbi is saying the same thing. The pandemic of Judaism today is Judaism by rote. That's what everybody's talking about. How do we... by rote. Everyone is talking about, yeah, I daven, but it's words. Yeah, I keep Shabbos, but it's boring. Yeah, I keep kosher, but it's expensive. Right? And there's certain dynamic, charismatic people that when like we see them, we're like, there's something there, and we run to it. Right? And these rebbeim are amazing, but they don't solve the problem. Because what they are, they're like glimpses. It's almost like a tease. Like, if I can get to... If I can get that, like I go to a Rabbi Y.Y. Jacobson Shear, right? And then I walk out, right? I go to a Rav Moshe Weinberger Shear. I go to like Rabbi Ephraim Waxman, right? And there's something there that like when I catch it, it's like, ah. And then I, for like a couple of days or maybe even a couple of weeks, I've got it. But then it fades. Right. There's something that's not working. What's the answer to that question? It's yes. This was an amazing pitch for a chizuk mission. Too bad Barry's not here. But yes. If Mrs. Fass is here, then I'll call it, everything is good. You can relay the message, yeah. But I'll tell you the truth. This chizuk mission, if done poorly, could just be the same thing. And then you're just living from chizuk mission to chizuk mission, which is great. Come back. Come back as often as possible. But wouldn't it be amazing if there was a shift that we could make within ourselves on these missions to take it with us, not to be perfect and not to always have like this level of inspiration, but to be in balance? That would be an amazing thing, right? Yes. Haman is the one that taught us how to do it. Haman said to Ahasuerus, I'm going to tell you the secret of Klal Yisrael's weakness. Right now, they're mefuzar umefura. They're separated from each other. Why are they living in a state of disharmony? Because each one of them is living from a place of I'm not enough. And when we live from a place of I'm not enough, we create disharmony with each other. It's happening in the Jewish world today. That famous article that was written many years ago, Mashiach wants to come, but he doesn't know what yarmulke to wear. He doesn't know what hat to wear. He doesn't know what bekesh to wear. He doesn't know what shtreimel to wear. He doesn't know how high his sock should be. Tucked in, tucked out. We've created the dumbest, most artificial words to create separation from each other.
Joey Newcomb has a beautiful song going again.
Yeah, Joey's that type of soulful person. Yeah. But the ridiculousness of it is that we know it's not true. You know how we know it's not true? There's a Rebbe in Mevaseret who grew up in the Five Towns. Actually, I know Mrs. Stoller knows him. His name is Rabbi Yosef Herschel, but back in the day he was friends with your son, Joey Herschel. There's a ice skating rink in Long Beach, and Rabbi Herschel and his brothers were there, and they were beating him up. He was the youngest kid. And a mother came over to them at the arena, and she said, "Stop picking on that kid." And he looked at them, and he looks at his mother, and he goes, "Don't tell my brothers what to do." He was like a little boy, yeah? We can fight with each other like crazy. Nobody fights like Jews fight. There's a famous line from the Lubavitcher Rebbe. How do you know if somebody is Jewish? You wish them a shalom aleichem. The first thing they say back is aleichem shalom. The way that you know if you're Jewish is if you disagree right away. Unless you're walking through an airport. If you're walking through an airport, you ever see how Jews walk by each other in an airport? We do this. It's called the Jew nod. Yeah, if you're walking by, you just do this. You go. Just a little nod to let you know. I travel a lot, so like I'm in like Dallas, and I'm like walking by somebody's like, I'm going from Dallas back to New York. They're going from New York to Dallas. They're walking by each other, and we're never going to see each other again. It's just in case anything goes down. We can fight with each other like crazy, but don't hit us, because then we're going to hit you back together. Our state of being in body is only until we're threatened. But then what happens? We awaken from our slumber of disconnection and we're Am Echad. All of a sudden, and that's exactly what the Pasuk says. V'yomer Haman l'melech Achashverosh, Yeshno Am Echad. There's one nation, they're one. But right now they're Mefuzar u'Mefurad. Right now we're scattered all over the place. We figured out how to say, you're that type of Jew. You got to go away. You're that type of Jew. You go away. I don't want my son sitting next to that kid in class. I don't want my son being in school with that kid. You know, I want to tell you something. I was expelled from school in fifth grade. It's true. I was expelled from school in fifth grade. And there were two people that would take me into school. One was Rabbi Hertzberg, Olav HaShalom, from South Shore. And the other was Rabbi Bender from Darche. And I ended up going to Darche. I'm a Darche kid. Fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth grade, or I should say halfway through fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth grade, were unbelievable years in my chinuch career. All the kids in my class were Rashi Yeshiva's kids. Like Rabbi Blumenkrantz, Olav HaShalom, his son was in my class. Rabbi Wilner, Rabbi Pitter, Rabbi Dicker. These were all my kids, like all my classmates were their sons. And I was like the kid who had been thrown out of Hafter. How come Rabbi Bender didn't say, look, we can't have that type of influence in the school? How come he didn't like keep me out? In fact, I'll tell you that for the first time in my life, fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth grade, I felt like I had this deep sense of belonging in the school, and I knew that no matter what happened, Rabbi Bender had my back.
Unconditional love.
What was that?
Unconditional love.
But why? Why weren't they concerned that I was going to share with my classmates ideas that maybe these kids didn't know? And by the way, I did. There are certain Gemaras that are more graphic in nature. And in eighth grade, I was learning Bechavrusa with one of these Rashi Yeshiva's kids, and it became clear to me that he did not understand what the Gemara was talking about. And for the first time in my entire chinuch career, I had what to teach this kid. Baruch Hashem, today he has a very large family. I take responsibility. Because we used to not be so afraid. Because the mentality of the Jewish world back then was, how can we not pull kids in? It's just like, we're here to serve kids. Since when did we lose sight of ourselves? And now the yeshivas and the seminaries are responding to the fears of the community. It's like, I can only take in this kid because otherwise those parents won't send because those families go there, so I can't take in those families. For the life of me, I can't understand it because I was that kid and I wouldn't be here speaking to you today if Rabbi Bender had treated me the way that yeshivas are treating kids today. It's even more than that. The money is being driven by the fear. It's this enormous fear that's coming from this deeply imbalanced place.
Like we're afraid of our children.
Right. I'm afraid of my kids, and therefore I have to be careful about that kid. It's like, what happened? Right. And it becomes shidduchim, and it becomes marriage, and it becomes I have to be perfect, and I have to look good. This is such a dysfunctional way of being, and nobody's stopping and waking up. So this is the answer. This Gemara is the answer. No. It has to be together.
Which Gemara is the answer?
This Gemara that we said in the beginning. This Gemara is the answer. Yeshno means, Haman is saying, the vulnerability of Klal Yisrael right now is that they're asleep. What does it mean to be asleep? When you're asleep, your mind and body don't work in harmony. Your soul ascends to Shemayim. That's why, by the way, what does the Gemara call sleep? It's a 60th of death. Right? So in a state of slumber where you're making contact with death, soul and body are separated. In that state, they have no shmirah from Hashem. Your predecessors couldn't get to the Jews because they were living from a deep place of soulfulness, and when you live from a place of soulfulness, they're invulnerable. So yeah, they might have had the mightier army, but it doesn't matter because they were together. We're never so powerful as when we're together. But right now, Haman says, they're asleep at the wheel. This is a shasa kosher. This is an opportunity to get them. So he knew our vulnerability, but he also betrayed himself by teaching us what it looks like not to live that way, and it's called being conscious, being awake, making decisions and choices every day to hit pause and ask myself, where am I operating from? Am I operating from the place of my soul and then my body follows suit, which is what it means to be awake? Or are we sleeping through life? That's the answer. The answer is hit pause. That thing you're afraid of, shidduchim. I'm just taking that because somebody said it before. What was that?
How did Haman teach that to us?
Because Haman said, look, they're asleep, which means the antidote is to be awake. Sleep is the body and soul are separated. The body follows, the soul follows the body in that case when you're sleeping, because the soul is disconnected. What we want to be is awake. We want to make conscious decisions from a deep place of soulfulness. So, finishing up, because I know you have to go. Shidduchim. Do we believe in the Torah or not? Do we believe in Chazal or not? So let's start like this. The Gemara tells us, Beferish, Arbaim Yom, 40 days before the Vlad is conceived, Abascal says Ploni will marry Plonis. All of our anxiety has nothing to do with the Shidduch. It doesn't. All it's doing is feeding the fear of the system, and now the fear breeds the fear. Do we want our daughters? I have 5 daughters, and I have 1 son. He's the last one. I just had my first grandson a month and change ago. I look like a grandfather, right? I do. Yeah? I'm just so excited to putter. That's all I ever wanted in my life, to putter. You know, I said, now I'm a real Zadie. So what are we going to do? We're going to raise our kids on the Shidduch crisis? Is that a good idea, to raise daughters growing up and going, just want you to know there's a Shidduch crisis, so you have to do everything perfect, and if everything on your resume isn't exactly perfect, this might not go well. Is that going to, like, first of all, let's say it works. How crazy is that? Let's say you have a daughter who does everything right because she's living from a deep place of fear. That's terrifying. That's terrifying because God knows what's happening inside that system. And let's say it doesn't work. And now every time your kid makes a mistake, you're sitting there going, what's going to be? What's going to be? What's going to be? What are you communicating to your kid? I'm not enough. You're not enough. Right? Nothing. Nobody's enough. We could hit pause and we could say, yeah, they had that article in the Five Towns Jewish Times and the Jewish Home and this, and whatever, all the different newspapers about the quote-unquote Shidduch crisis, right? Or we could choose to impart to our children, I have deep faith that you are somebody who's worthy of love and connection, and I'm sure in the right time with the right one, if you show up in self, you'll be a magnet of attraction of love and connection. What's a healthier way of parenting our children? We could sit and blame the system, or we could hit pause and choose to act differently. Yeshno am echad. If we wake up from our slumber, then what are we? We're one nation. Why do we need to wait until some Rishoyim Arurim come over the border and, I can't even describe, and do what they did to wake us up? It's not even massacre and butcher. It's so far beyond. It's really, the word is barbaric. We saw things on October 7th on Simchas Torah. We saw things that people have not seen for generations. For generations. This is like what you read about in books, like Attila the Hun. And now we wake up and go, Taka, you know, we're all Jews. Why does somebody need to scream in order to wake us up? Being conscious is a choice. Right. Okay. And I see that she did this already.
Rabbi Niven.
Okay. Who?
Rabbi Niven.
Oh, Rabbi Niven. Okay. He's wonderful. Yeah? So this is our opportunity. This is our opportunity right now. In our Judaism, as parents, as spouses, as members of Klal Yisrael, if we're going to bring Mashiach, the first step is to wake up. Once you're awake, you get to make choices. I'll finish with this line from Rabbi Nachman. It's one of my favorite lines. Rabbi Nachman says, choice is always available. And today, that's not obvious, because people say, well, he's an addict, he doesn't have choice. No. The person who we think has lost choice has choice. When we're in a state of, I feel like I don't have choice anymore, choice is available to us. We're just sleeping, but choice is always an option. Okay, I'm looking forward to seeing you on Shabbos. Have a wonderful rest of your day.